This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman. This is the London FinTech Podcast, episode 248, brought to you in association with Smart and thelistedboard.com. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Neil Holden to talk about FS boards. As Neil has sat on FS/banking/fintech boards and chaired subcommittees of such for some 20 years, he's an excellent person to talk about this topic. We have on the podcast covered boards before, whether the startup-y, scale-up-y, or boards in general. However, and it is often not sufficiently understood both in business as a whole, but also amongst younger fintechs, that there are some substantial differences and qualitative differences between FS boards and other boards. For the developing fintech that is slightly unaware of this, this can be territory they venture into gradually before the penny drops. This is very much an extreme case for banking boards, as banking is, as Professor John Kay said when he was on the show, akin to a group of folks going to a pub, gambling amongst themselves, and the impact of their game within the pub affects people who haven't even been to the pub. However, with two decades of experience, no doubt Neil can take us beyond these simplistic and confusing metaphors, albeit they get merit by mentioning pubs. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Good morning, Neil. Thank you for joining me on the show today.
Good morning, Mike. It's lovely to be here with you.
So, in terms of chit-chatty introduction and trying to establish the guest as a human being, which is sometimes challenging. One of the organic human-y things that I knew you happened to do is play the hurdy-gurdy or something similar to that in your spare time. And hurdy-gurdy is a very strange instrument. I saw that recently on television, or actually what I call YouTube these days is television.
No, Mike, it's much more prosaic than that. It's the accordion that I play. So the hurdy-gurdy is a mystery to me. But yes, I do like playing music, mainly I play Scottish, Irish traditional music, so music for dancing, ceilidhs, that sort of thing. Love a lot of fast tunes, and I love going down the pub, so I'm very at home with John Kay's comment there.
Excellent. Well, we'll discuss pubs later. So how long have you been musicking? And were you always sort of squeeze boxing from an early age, you know, literally from the womb? Or was it something you took up later?
No, I was taught piano as a child, classical music, but then did nothing and strayed away from music for many years, but then came back to it in later life, particularly when I started going to Scotland a lot because I kept a boat up there. I just fell in love with Scottish traditional music. So I got a decent accordion and started learning how to play it. It's quite a transition, actually, from piano to accordion, because piano is both hands on a keyboard, accordion, you've got this massive array of buttons for the left hand, which is, so it's actually very good for your brain. So hopefully the onset of Alzheimer's and whatnot will be slightly delayed in my case through all of this having to push, squeeze, play keyboard and push buttons at the same time, but we shall see.
I see, and I'm not a fan of, great fan of folk music as such, although I have got into Heilung recently. But as you're in the east of England, Bridget used to be a big fan of the Cambridge Folk Festival back in the day, and I think there are all sorts of folk bands there from all over the place. But in terms of your cultural appropriation here, what's wrong with English folk music, or is it just not so much fun to dance to insofar as you've gone for the sort of the Gaelic fringes?
I don't want to that's a very sensitive subject.
Brilliant. I love stitching up guests.
And I don't want to be stitched up particularly, but you're right. So music in pubs around where I live there's a lot of what I call Morris tunes and Morris music. And whilst I can play them, they don't hold a great fascination for me because they're typically quite simple tunes. I prefer the intricacy of a lot of Irish music. A lot of it's in the minor key, which is very, they make some very beautiful tunes with some surprising rhythm changes. And then the Scottish music as well, which is actually usually a lot brighter than Irish music. A lot of Scottish music is in very bright keys like A and E. And it has a very different sort of lilt to it, but they're related. And often you get the same tune just played in a different style, and you can tell whether it's Irish or Scottish as a result. So that's what fascinates me.
Ah, interesting. We should definitely be on some folk music podcast, because there's a whole world in there. I mean, just briefly, in terms of having been classical piano and now accordioning, I had a buddy back in the day. don't have any anymore.
Once,
yes. That was before lockdown. I had a friend. Well, actually, it was a colleague, to be honest. I better not sort of exaggerate too much. Anyway, it's very interesting in that both he and his wife played the piano, but they played it and had learned it in very different ways. And his wife was very good. If you gave her some sheet music in front of her with like a million squiggles on, because she could play all the squiggles in the right order and that kind of stuff. My buddy wasn't so good at that. But what my buddy was very good at, talking of pubs, was walking into a pub and just playing, because he'd learned from a sort of more jazzy teacher, improv-y teacher. And these were almost like the yin and the yang, the antithetical ways that you can approach music. Now, I assume that if you did classical music properly at school, you were taught in the proper logical, linear-y, left-brainy way and all that kind of stuff, and you carry on long enough to try and make it sound musical and escape the sort of the tight binds of metronomic rhythms and this kind of stuff.
Did you
learn the accordion the same way, or did you learn the accordion, as it were, the opposite way, which is, oh, look, I'll press these buttons, oh, it makes some notes, oh, and then you kind of learn it sort of organically as opposed to systematically? I know that I've got the wrong words, but you can kind of work out what the question should be.
And it's interesting you should mention learn music in the left brain way, because one of the books I'm reading at the moment, which is called The Master and His Apprentice, is about different roles of the left and right brains. And in fact, what the studies show is that an amateur musician mostly uses their right brain to play music, not the left brain. And if you become a professional and very proficient, you use both, apparently. So there you go. Isn't that strange? But you're right. In the old understanding of left brain, where it's very mechanical and you read what says on the page and you reproduce it exactly, classical music is scored with all of the intonations and everything, so you're given a complete set of instructions to reproduce it if you're capable. Whereas with traditional music, I mean, for the accordion, you will only be given the tune, the treble, so you will have to work out for yourself what to do with the bass on the right, on the left hand, and you will have to work out for yourself how to swing it or you know, what sort of rhythm, how rhythmically to play it. So there's a lot more sort of ability to improvise and interpret. So you're given the bare bones of the tune. Obviously, in a pub, it's too dark to read music anyway. And it's not a great look, actually, sitting staring at sheets of music in a pub. What you want to do is to stare at your colleagues and play with them, and possibly stare at your beer and wonder why no one's bought you another one. So it's better to learn it. And a lot of folk musicians cannot read music.
Interesting. Right. Okay. So moving on from that nice and smooth change of gear, perhaps we might say it's the same about banking and boards, in that if you can buy a textbook from a shop which gives you all the dots and all the rules and all the intonations and all that thou shalt do's and all this kind of stuff, especially these days compared to the past. But the challenge is actually making music that's actually human and real and does things properly, as opposed to just connecting the dots or playing them like a MIDI music player. But before we dive into the question of FS boards, small to massive, etc., maybe you'd like, Neil, to briefly let the audience know about your career journey. As you're even older and wiser than I am, your career journey is quite extensive, so we don't need to go over every iota of it. But I do happen to know you started as an accountant, which is a sort of fascinating way to start a career.
Yeah, I started with a proper education, so I was a mathematician, then lurched into accountancy, mainly because in the milk routes, such as they had in those days, the accountants who I joined offered free whiskey to the students who were... It was a Scottish accounting firm, so I thought, well, this must be a fantastic career if you get free whiskey. So I went for that. Then after that, into banking. It was financial control in those days, but then somebody invented the phrase risk management, so it morphed into that. And then latterly, after a career in sort of executive and risk roles in banking, I made what was, at the time, a quite unwise move into non-exec directorships. So it was just the cusp of Basel II, which, as you remember, was making capital calculations complicated and models and things like that. And I stupidly thought this would mean that boards would need people who understood this sort of stuff. And of course, nothing of the sort occurred. Boards resolutely avoided having anybody on the boards who understood anything about capital management for quite a few years. So I had a period in the wilderness, but eventually they cracked and they had to put people like me on boards. So I then had a, an non-exec career in, on banking boards, doing audit committees and risk committees mainly, but everything else, senior independents and REMCOs and NOMCOs and so on. And latterly, I've been on the board of Saffron Building Society, which I left in May of last year because I'd done my 9 years, and a big financial platform with integrated financial arrangements, which again, I left after, I think, 12 years in that case. So here I am.
Yes, the many people think that it's good to be right and early, but you don't want to be too early because there's quite a lot of sitting at the bus stop waiting for the bus. You might have got the, you might be the first person in the world to work out this is a great bus, or this is a great entrepreneurial idea, or this is a great career move, but you sit there waiting for the bus, looking at your watch. And
I did, yeah, and I peaked too soon. It was that thing, so I had to go and do consulting instead, which was where I met you. So that it was no bad thing in the end.
Yes, indeed, it was some time ago now. So, just starting off with the delta between FS boards and other boards. As I say, you've got a couple of decades of it by now, and you could no doubt talk for quite a long time about this. But let's just start with a felt sense, going back to the music. What's the felt sense of sitting on an FS board compared to others from the non-executive perspective? Is it sort of basically, oh shit, I hope this doesn't fuck up, and if it does fuck up, it can fuck up really, really badly and pull the whole economy down, as Northern Rock did, which tends not to be the case if you're on the board of Sainsbury's. It's sort of, oh dear, how sad, Sainsbury's went bust. Oh well, people will go to Tesco's or whatever, and Tesco's hasn't gone bust because Sainsbury's gone bust. It's like this sort of contagion spreading. I mean, so there's the sort of the felt sense, just to start off with that, the human being sense. And then the second thing is more formally, what kind of factors lead to the challenges?
I think at the heart of the financial services board challenge, large or small, is that you are... Well, the phrase we used to use at Integrated Financial Arrangements is you're looking after Mrs. Miggins's money. So you have a fiduciary duty to Mrs. Miggins, take good care of that money and not lose it. And that's different, as you say, to the Sainsbury's board. And what that does, I think, is on very big company boards, there are a lot of interested parties. So, you know, the government is interested in what you do. Politicians are interested in what you do. You will be regulated, but if you're in financial services, they're absolutely fascinated in what you do. And even if you're small, you're regulated and you have this fiduciary duty and the politicians and everyone are interested in what you do. So what happens is that fascination with your business and the want to control the way you do it and how you behave in it sets in for very small companies. And that's probably where your comment about the surprise factor comes in. Is, you know, if you're Sainsbury's, will have a massive panoply of governance and so on, but a corner shop won't. Whereas if you are the equivalent of a corner shop in financial services, you do. So you've got to cope with all of that. And you've got to cope with it when your business is brand new and of a scale that is very small indeed. So that's the essential difference. It's the amount of regulation and outside interest in how you run your business, the scale at which you, when you're still small or very new.
I remember that when Monzo was quite young and Tom had all sorts of idea about how to do banks differently, not being a banker or whatever. And this conversation with the FCA, trying to be regulated or the Bank of England or whoever it was about, hey, I've got some great new ideas. All right, okay. Yeah, but you're not a banker. Well, that's why I've got the great new ideas. And, and literally, I'm not joking. I mean, that's a sort of, you know, what are the essences of a conversation that took many months?
Yeah, you're right. And the FCA say we have this very large and very sharp cookie cutter, and we're going to apply it to you.
Quite. And in the end, I think that they managed to get to a compromise that he did get a deputy chief executive who was very solid banking. I mean, it's a good analogy in terms of the corner shop starting with a sort of half of Sainsbury's board, as it were. Just to dispense with this point on banking, so we can just stick with sort of FS rather than banking per se. And I do recall in the very early days of fintech, I don't know, 2014 or something, the first time I met Tom at some small panel when Monzo had barely taken off. I did ask him, I hope he doesn't mind me repeating the question. So, okay, Tom, you're a bank, so what are you going to do about asset and liability management? He looked blank, he'd never heard about it. And so asset and liability management and old-fashioned phrases like that are really around the alchemy of producing money out of thin air. And that's the essence, and the essence that you've produced it out of thin air and you don't actually have it, and all this sort of stuff about, oh, I've got my money deposited in Monzo. Well, actually, they don't have that either. So there's all that kind of alchemy behind banking. And going back to one of the challenges, which I think is why politicians get interested, I mean, why should they be interested? Why should so many regulators be interested? Well, even back in the day, before the sort of state got massively involved in defining how boards work, there's been a big problem with banking per se. And after the 2008 crisis, it's now been long forgotten about. But I think I mentioned John Kay, and I think he or one of his colleagues at the FT were on a panel about how we reform banking and narrow banking and all these things, yardy. But one of the problems that is unresolved is that, well, if I was being harsh and just trying to sort of simplify, you know, the banking model doesn't really work. It is kind of broken, which is why the, sort of, the Swiss had ideas about central bank only creating money, and now we've come off the gold standard. We touched on all that before. So anyway, so banking is a very special case. But as many fintechs know who aren't banks, most fintechs aren't banks, even if you're not banks, and then the regulators are all over you, not least of which, because they don't want you losing people's money or stealing it and running off with it, and that makes it all very complex. So anyway, so you've got this complexity around not just the banking, but fiduciary duty. As you say, there are a number of players involved who've got an idea about what you should be doing on your board and all that kind of stuff. Just going back to boards in general, and particularly the complexity, as I'm probably more aware than most, boards weren't always this way, firstly. And secondly, they weren't always this complex. And in the third subtopic, we'll talk about boards in the 21st century and all this regulation and ESGs and all that kind of jazz that's been heaped on by the state onto what are still called private companies, or actually called public companies, but it still means they're private, it just means they're on the public stock exchange. But boards in general went through this phase change from the 90s onwards in US and UK of getting immensely complicated. And one of the things that started appearing, I'd mentioned that you chaired various subcommittees, is subcommittees of boards. Now, it's really interesting, actually. It's quite hard to get back to the contrary opinions around the sort of 90s when all this sort of corporate governance came in and the whole corporate governance industrial complex, third only to big pharma and a big military, perhaps, these days. But the idea of a unitary board, or even the two-level board in Europe, was that you have a bunch of folks who know about everything that's going on. But then, because rules came in, and more rules and more rules, we live in a world of rules, talking about McGilchrist's left brain stuff, there got to be so much that sort of the board meeting would take 48 hours and people would fall asleep even more than they used to fall asleep in a board meeting. And so someone had the bright idea of having sub-boards, which they then called subcommittees, and you've got your, I don't know, you've got your REMCOM looking at remuneration, you've got the audit com and all this kind of stuff. So in terms of the general stuff and the huge overload of what the board is responsible for and has to do and all that kind of stuff, as somebody who has lived through it on many, many boards, how do you see this whole topic of you suddenly had one forum, this was the board, it had a board meeting, the important things were discussed, everyone knew about it, to, well, I haven't a clue about remuneration because that's him, and I haven't a clue about audit because that's you. So, well, hang on. So how can I actually be a director, A, looking after myself, which, of course, all NEDs have to do, otherwise they'll get banned for life, and B, looking after the company, its shareholders, its employees, and minor matters like that. So how do you see that sort of almost two-dimensional organogramization of a board, which used to be just one square box called the board?
Yeah. Well, there's kind of two things have driven that, I think, Mike, over the years. One is the theory of governance, which is this idea that, you know, unless you have an independent director, or unless the committee or whatever is comprised of independent directors, they aren't doing proper oversight. But particularly things like audit committees and, to a slightly lesser extent, risk committees, though these days risk committees tend to be exclusively the parish of independent directors, though there used to be a mixed committee, actually, when I started out doing these things. There's this requirement that you have to exclude certain, you know, executive board members from the membership of these committees for them to perform their role properly. But of course, the committee can't operate unless they're present in the room, because they wouldn't know anything about anything otherwise. So this, it is slightly absurd in that, if you like, things like risk committees, the non-members do most of the talking and the members do most of the listening. And the other thing is, I sort of return to this brain analogy of a board, the left and the right brain. Now, the board has two roles, and there is its left brain role, which is this need to dive into MI and basically uncover detail where necessary and be interested in exactly what's going on and how it's being done. And there's this right brain strategic lateral thinking, where do we take the company over the medium term thing, which is a completely different role. And particularly in financial services, what happens is that the interest of regulators and the amount, the volume of left brain stuff that the board has to do just swamps. So, you know, you get the fag packet end of the board meeting to talk about the staff or strategy or things like that. You're just deluged in compliance and audit and risk and other things. So I think the ways that these subcommittees can serve a board is to free it up from some of that stuff and take the detail in a subcommittee somewhere else and give the board some breathing space to do its proper role. So that it can be a good thing. But you're right, it actually gives you two, it does push against the idea of a unitary board, which is still the legal structure of a board, in that the exec are just as responsible for auditing matters as the non-execs, it's just they don't get to have a say in it.
Yes, there is legally no such thing as a non-executive director. You are a director of the company. In the UK, it's that you're at company's house. If the company sinks, oh dear, that's not good for you as well as the company. And there isn't a distinction made between the people who come in for a day or two a month and the people who are there every day. The independence, yes, that's a sort of a huge new trope. And talking of Professor John Kay, I remember mentioning to him, I don't remember if it's on the podcast or off the podcast, hopefully on the podcast, which was an analogy between aircraft safety and financial services safety. The whole world has a great interest in the safety of the financial services system, as people found in 2008. If your bank goes bust, then your whole life is, pardon my French, fucked. And even in the case of Landsbanki, where all the UK taxpayers got repaid by the insurance system, it took something 12 months, something. Well, if you're a nurse or a teacher and your only money in the world is in that, what you're going to do in the meantime. So the whole world's got a massive interest in banking safety, but also financial services safety. ISAs, SIPs, PEPs, you name them, whatever, all these kind of structures are in some financial services entity, and you might need it and you don't want to cock it up. And equally, the whole world has got a massive interest in aircraft safety and in flying being safe, planes not dropping out of the sky. And the point that I made to John, which hadn't occurred to him before, was that the thing about airline safety is that the regulators of airline safety are constrained by the need for the plane to fly in the sky. So if you have a crash and the wing had fallen off, oh dear, the wing's fallen off, make it stronger. Another crash, we make it stronger. Well, a certain point of over-regulation, shall we say, that the plane can literally not take off and not perform its job at all. And therefore, there is a natural constraint on how, let's just say, poorly it's regulated. In financial services, and this was recognised, I think, around 08, et cetera, by the Bank of England, but these things fade in the background very quickly. In financial services, as a whole, there is no limit to the amount of regulation. As I was moaning, MiFID II is 10 times the length of the Bible. They can make it 100 times the length of the Bible. Now, the plane still works, but what actually happens is a number of things, which is, firstly, the costs go up for the consumer, because this is all very invisible, because every regulation has a cost, and whatever the number is at Citigroup, 20% of Citigroup in London are busy doing things for regulators in one way or another. So, you know, there's an overhead. And then, more indirectly, the rest of the bank has to take more risk to pay for the dead weight who are not profit makers. So the percentage of the company profit makers go up, therefore the risk takers have to take more risk, and therefore that ends up being regulated. And then you've got a third thing, and maybe you can talk about the scale factor here. We haven't talked about boards, and definitely applies to FS boards. We've talked about subcommittees of boards, but also there's subsidiaries of companies and branches and all these kind of things maybe around the world. And it's very different if you're, say, the Saffron Building Society, and for the sake of argument, you've got one headquarters and that's pretty much it, to your Citigroup and you're in, you know, 5,000 countries around the world. And then you get to another problem, which is the too big to understand, let alone too big to manage. I mean, as I always say, if you put me on the board of Citigroup or HSBC tomorrow, how could I have a clue about almost anything that it did? I'd receive some aggregate of an aggregate of an aggregate of an aggregate statistic. So maybe you'd like to talk just along the spectrum of small FS companies. I mean, I think you did work on a sort of startup-y board, which is, I don't know, half a dozen people or a dozen people in the company or whatever. And also you've worked on quite big companies as well. So there must be a real big change along that spectrum.
Well, there is, as you say, when you're working in companies with a handful of employees, that the board will know every employee. So management or oversight by walking around is very easy. So you can get a feel for who's competent, who isn't, what they're doing or what they're not doing. And you just cannot have that in a larger company. So you're much more dependent on the MI, management information, I do apologise for jargoning. And you're much more dependent on management's perception of what's going on and what they report to you, or management perception of what they want you to hear when they report it to you. Because there's this fascinating thing, I mean, like in quantum physics, where if you measure something, you change it. It's kind of the same for boards. So what they get interested in and what they demand the management to show them affects what management does in a real way. So the board says, well, we're very interested in the employees. We want to meet the employees and see the mezzanine layer. Management will ensure that they get prepped and that they will ensure that they speak the narrative. So it's kind of, the bigger the company is, the harder it is for the board to get inside the mind of the company, as opposed to inside the mind of the company that management want you to see. But you need to do it. So you have to be very careful to make sure that the board isn't solely informed by what management provides to you, and that you do get down and do your oversight by walking around, and you do have informal meetings with other staff, and you find other ways of getting into surveys, whatever, other ways of getting into what's going on in the business. As you say, these businesses can be enormous, and you have no means to, there's no osmotic way you will get a feeling for what's going on.
So an interesting angle on that, which listeners may not be that aware of, is as a non-executive director, I mean, as an executive director, you're part of the organogram and you're there every day and you're just like a senior employee, really. But as a non-executive director, charged with as much risk as the executives who are there every day and know way more than you do, what authority powers do you have to say to the CEO or whoever, look, we're going to wander around your treasury department and chat to them all or something, or we're going to hire lawyers and we're going to do this report on you all, or what is formally or practically, what are the independent powers of the independent non-executive? What can they actually do on their own without, as it were, asking for the sort of the passcode for the front door because they can't get through the digital lock?
You rarely have any independent powers personally. Although committees will, and to take your latter point, committees will often have powers to instruct lawyers or advisors or whatever as a committee. But as an individual, you don't. But I think you'd be unwise to make a nuisance of yourself on the shop floor without the support of the management team. But if the management team are unduly obstructive in letting you do that, that tells you something of itself. So it's a compromise. As always, you need to do these things, but you need to do them sensitively, and you need not to try and split the board so it's if you like, two sides, management v the NEDs. That doesn't work either.
Yes, and of course, by painting a sort of a yin-yang spectrum of extremes, as always, I'm pointing to the fact that there's a need for balance in the middle, and you know that implies to me that, especially in these kind of businesses, that there's even more onus on the chairman, when Brian Basham was on the show talking about being a chairman, to ensure that the board is as seamless as possible and everyone's concerns are allowed. And when it's a board, everybody is a director. And, you know, there's quite an art to chairing things well like that and ensuring that everyone feels they are the same part. And, my one takeaway, I remember from what Brian was saying, was that the most important thing that the chairman can do is ensure that people don't squabble, which is a very simplistic thing. But he's got, 60 years of this stuff, so he must know.
Yes, I mean, it's a sort of similar thing. When I left Integrafin, Integrated Financial Arrangements, the chairman made a comment about me, which I took as a compliment, but he might have meant it as an insult, actually. But he said, basically, the net job, you need to be good at poking your nose in, but not your fingers. And I think that sort of sums up the proper role of an NED. You must poke your nose into things, but if you start poking your fingers in as well, then you're starting to become an exec, and that is an issue.
Yes. Okay. The mind's going all sorts of directions with that. With that metaphor, moving swiftly on as to what one inserts where. So that's given us a feel. I think we'll wrap up at the end with perhaps some practical advice, as you've got grey hair, no hair, for younger folk on what they should be bearing in mind if they're a NED of a fintech, of an FS, or anything like that. You know, what advice, what avuncular advice you would give them. But before we get into that, then we get into the challenge of the 21st century. And as I've mentioned on the podcast before, for my sins and due to my idiocy in writing a book about the small company board, I happened by mistake to write 100,000 words on the history of the company the last 500 years. It's actually a very interesting story. However, I've written it up to basically the year 2000, and I have no chapter on the 21st century and my provisional sort of, my mental idea of the 21st century board is, oh shit, what the hell do I write about that? Because there's so much. And by so much, I'm talking about things like ESG, which is Musk's perspective as a sperm of the devil and enabling sort of black rocks and all this kind of thing. You've got the, what I call DAI, diversity and all that kind of wokey stuff. And overall, coming back to the initial point about the number of interested parties in financial services boards, got on steroids what you're seeing in the economy as a whole, which is that corporate governance now exists. It didn't used to, it literally did not used to exist. I mean, it was Harold Wilson's autobiography in the 1970s that reintroduced the word governance, which actually hadn't been heard since Chaucer. But now there's a whole bloody industry and universities studying it and all that kind of stuff. And in a sense, if you look at what led up to the 1990s, particularly in America, you had loads of companies going bust and banks and all this kind of stuff. Banks often go bust anyway. And there were two sort of, let's just caricature it as usual, two camps, the free market camp and the kind of, well, we need, the state needs to tell, nanny state needs to tell them how to do it. And that was sorted out. You know, we'll get some sort of bureaucrats or the great and the good or whatever, and they'll come up with rules and all this kind of thing. But going back to the broken problem, the free market bit itself, it doesn't really work because the banking model, I think, is fundamentally broken. And there's a notable example I give in the 19th century of the failure of two banks, one of which was an unlimited liability bank. So it's like Lloyd's insurance market. So all the directors and shareholders had unlimited liability. So let's say you were driving around on a motorbike with no helmet and no protection, you might drive it a bit more carefully, at least if you're not a 17-year-old lad. You might. Anyway, whole complex series of things in the background. So a pure free market thing is a little bit challenging. But the interesting thing about governance as a whole, and again, I'm the only person who's heard this, but I've got a big thick book on my desk called A History of Corporate Governance Around the World, edited by Randall Mork. Where did corporate governance arise first? Corporate governance arose first in 1930s Germany under a political party called the NSDAP. Now, the interesting thing there was that the German state in the 1930s wanted to control companies. And it's very interesting, actually, because that was national socialism, as we know. And international socialism, as it were, was in Russia, where they just disposed of companies, per se. Yeah. So if I'm being historically accurate, I was about to say cheeky, it's not cheeky, it's just historically accurate to say that corporate governance first came in that, and the state would have someone on the board, in the same way that I think the Communist Party in Russia, if you're on a submarine, would have some sort of commissar standing over your shoulder, even if you're the captain of the submarine or whatever, looking at it, saying, not so sure about that.
Yeah.
And so you've got this world now where, in a genuine attempt to try and sort out the perceived challenges of companies going bust, and in particular in FS going bust, but not actually addressing the FS model in the way that narrow banking was going to address it in some of the proposals of 2008, which got watered down due to the political power of financial institutions. You've got this ever-increasing amount of rules. I have great sympathy with the regulator and regulators myself, because having been in risk, as I've said many times, no one ever thanks you. No one ever said, hey, you did a great job. They say, no. The banks have made loads of money, or the divisions have made loads of money. But if something goes wrong, they say, hey, Mike, what, you know, or hey, Mr. FSA, or hey, Mr. Bank of England. So their incentives are very much to keep adding stronger wings, as it were, as much as possible. So you're in this kind of mess. And we've also then got the whole sort of separate tangent of the kind of move to 2030, World Economic Forum, all those kind of agendas as well. As a result of which, to me, that it seems to me an increasingly thankless task to want to be a NED on a financial services board, certainly a big one, because the number of rules you have to follow, the number of people who are going to do their nutty if something cocks up, when life cocks up anyway, we all know that. So it just gets harder and harder. So again, let's just start from the personal perspective. Having sat on the board for the last 20 years, boards, many of them, you've seen these changes. I mean, you mentioned independent, for example. I remember one of the tales you told me about, you're on the bank of a board of a Middle Eastern bank. And you said after 10 years, sorry, I've got to go. And they said, why? And they said, well, there's a rule. And the rule says that 10 years, I'm no longer independent. And they said, no, but you're the most independent director we have. So this is a clash of civilizations there. There's a different way, which is human, a world of human beings who judge other human beings and use their savvy, which is what's happened for most of the last 500 years in this country, versus the McGilchrist world of rules and regulations. Anyway, it's a huge barrage of an introduction here, but what's it felt like as a human being to sit on boards and have just more and more rules and more, oh God, I'm going to piss them off now if I fuck that up, or if this rule is broken or whatever. And then practically, in terms of how people manage this, how on earth do they manage this? Or just more? Is it just more and more subcommittees to do more and more rules?
Not really. So I think, my perception of how things have changed over the last 10, 20 years is that, you're right, it's aligned to the way society has altered over the last 10, 20 years is the abuse of governance. So there are many government and government actors like regulators and things, and they have their agenda. And they're using the governance process in companies to impose their agenda on companies. So things like ESG, DEI, things like that. Boards have to deal with these issues. And they have to comply. And in many ways, these are written as guidance, but you're under no illusion that this guidance is to be followed. And this happens more and more. So I think the challenge for boards in the 21st century is avoiding groupthink. Because I think whilst governments and regulators might write papers saying that groupthink is something to be avoided, they're busily imposing it like mad. So somehow boards have got to, you know, play their part in society properly and, you know, and do the right things whilst avoiding groupthink when they're being told what to think by regulators in many cases. So I think that's the big challenge. And it's just, I see some light at the end of the tunnel here, because my sense of where society is that it's becoming more acceptable in the last few years to challenge some of these groupthink ideas. So I think there's some hope, but that is, I think, the difficult thing for boards at the moment.
Yes, and as you say, the example of boards is a result of societal factors. I mean, one you haven't mentioned is suddenly changed since we were young, which is the idea that nothing should ever go wrong.
Yeah.
And once you start trying to make sure that nothing ever goes wrong, well, nothing ever happens. And to your point earlier, boards have always had two sides of the coin. They've always had the corporate control. You don't want your lovely business to blow up. That's a pity. But equally, they've always had the corporate creativity. And all fintechs will go through the journey as they get larger. And it's the same as getting older. You get stiffer and more rigid. They'll go through the journey, be incredibly flexible like a baby. And they can move and develop into anything until you've got sort of, you know, 40 years on your LinkedIn CV. And then it's very difficult to go off and become a sort of professional accordionist or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
You've always had that. But then ever since Cadbury, And Cadbury, in his report in 1992, says this is only about corporate control. Corporate control is merely one of the important functions of a board, and a more important function is the longer term. And really,
exactly.
In terms of anti-dualism, there is no distinction between corporate creativity and corporate control, because if you want to really control the risks in an organisation, well, the biggest risk is the world changes in the future, you don't move and your business goes bust, even though you're ticking all the boxes. So I think we're in a sort of situation, and it feels like this is society as a whole, where, as many people have noted from many different perspectives, whether it's political or whatever, we are on a path, we can't keep going down this direction. We can't keep having more and more regulators, more and more rules, more and more imposition of social agendas onto companies, as well as the ones. And Jordan Peterson has made the point a long time ago, actually. He was asked, well, what do you think woke is? And he said, I think it's a war on meritocracy. And having mentioned the aircraft before, notoriously, if you spend 10 minutes on Twitter, a while ago, the FAA was, you know, trying to find all sorts of people for its agenda. Well, no, the FAA's job is really important, you know, in the same way that you've got a brain surgeon. I personally don't care about people's gender, sexuality or anything anyway, but I don't want a brain surgeon who's been chosen on the basis of you know, a bunch of social codes. I want a really good brain surgeon. So I don't think it can continue in this way. But like many things, it's very hard to see what will actually turn out. I almost sometimes think the world's going to bifurcate into a super-controlled, we're going to obey all the orders kind of thing, and a more organic-y people playing the organs and trading in silver coins and gold coins and not CBDCs. But that's just a sort of, you know, sketch. But anyway, bring it back to the boards. The point you're making is it's more and more challenging to just actually do the job, any job in those circumstances.
It's more and more challenging to do half of the job. So if, like, societal pressure is to turn boards into left-brain actors, which is to be mechanical, to obey the rules, make sure the rules are obeyed, and to groupthink that those rules are right all the time. And the right-brain side of a board, which is, you say, the strategy, the peering forward, changing what the company does, doing things better, or questioning the way things are done, is frowned upon at the moment, and it's hard for a board to get into that space, but it must.
And so in that way, you see many companies forming advisory boards, which are not formal legal boards, but you get a group of people sitting around chewing the fat, kicking things around, you know, shooting the breeze, blah, 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 and coming up with the sort of creative stuff. So how do you see, going back to the breakdown of a unitary board into subcommittees already, but then you get this sort of whole parallel organisation that says, look, you're the boring auditors and accountants and you're the rule followers, you're the governance thing, you're going to tick those billion rules we have to tick, look, can't do anything about it, let's not worry about it, and we're the fun guys who are going to go off and have all the fun and do the creative businessy stuff, which in itself does end up more with a bureaucratisation of the board, where the rules have been set by bureaucrats for bureaucrats, and that all the people are doing on that FS board is performative box ticking. But in the meantime, this sort of, metaphorically speaking, the CEO has nipped over the fence, and in another room he has the sort of fun he used to have back in the day when he was a lad.
Well, that's why boards go on strategy days or whatever and do things that aren't minuted. I think that's quite important. But going back to your point about, if you like, the liabilities for board members increasing because there's kind of more things that can go wrong, and there's this desire by regulators imposed on them by politicians, actually, after the last bank failures, to pin the tail on the donkey, which means find someone senior that can be held to account, is that whilst a lot of this complicated stuff is naturally the parish of the subcommittees, the regulators try and push it back into the boardroom by forcing you to have a board champion for something, like, you know, you have to have a consumer duty champion who's a board member. You know, there has to be an employee champion who's on the REMCO. So they're actually trying to pin individual board members to individual aspects of governance, which sort of takes it out of the committees and out of the whole board, and actually forces a certain board member to behave in a certain way to protect themselves.
Yes, so as we can see, that, as you say, there's a number of societal changes in that which are definitely impacting boards, and this is becoming more and more of a sort of unsustainable thing, and something's going to happen. It will not be like this in 25 years' time, one way and another. So putting all that sort of big philosophy to one side, let's just narrow it down to simple, more practical stuff. So if you are just, for the moment, talking to a listener out there who's about to be invited onto a fintech board, FS in some circumstances, of a business of some scale, in terms of avuncular advice that you might want to give them in terms of the key points that you'd make that perhaps you spent 20 years learning the very hard way, the journey of life, but you might save them 20 years of unnecessary pain. What would they be?
Well, I think first take it seriously is one thing. The other thing, I think the board and the board personality is very important. You're going to spend a lot of time in the boardroom, never mind all this video rubbish that's happened for a while. I think boards meet better in person. You're going to spend a lot of time with these colleagues. It's much easier if you can get along with them and like them. So I think very carefully about who are your colleagues and whether you actually want to be in a room with them for a day, a month, for the next 9 years. And you need to bring something to the party. Either you're bringing experience, either you're bringing something left field if the board are trying to produce some sort of experiential or professional diversity to it or whatever. So you need to know why you are on that board and what your particular role is.
And presumably another factor is that it's important that you have some respect for the chairman. I mean, you don't have to actually like the guy, but you need to be able to professionally go in with the chairman, because the chairman is such a crux.
Yeah.
If you're having an interview, let's say, or someone says, oh, come on the board, go, oh, great, I'll come on the board, and you've never even met the chairman, let's say, because you got quits promoted onto the board. That's actually, of course, a vital relationship, because he is primus inter pares.
And it's the relationship between the chair and the chief executive is crucial as well, because if those two people don't respect each other, there's going to be, the board is going to be a mess until it's sorted.
Excellent. Well, OK, so that's a nice point to end on. Having gone down the sort of left-brainy stuff, this is the more sort of heart-centric-y, human relationship-y stuff. And I think it's a point well made that for the sort of more unsuspecting younger person, it's really important to understand the social dynamics of that, because the board is certainly a team. And if the business goes down, all the board goes down. You may have kept yourself a little audit trail saying, oh, I said this at this meeting and that at that meeting. But HSBC has still gone bust. And you're on the board, and as we've seen recently, when they weren't even going bust, they were flayed alive in, I don't know, some select committee in Westminster by politicians, sort of giving them a good kicking for some random reasons I can't quite remember. And to your point about seriousness, I'd just like to emphasise that point even more. I mean, in a sense, yes, of course, one takes it seriously, but I think the way that I would phrase that from my perspective is that the downside is significant. The downside is significant, especially on an FS board and especially on a banking board. And you as a human being do not want to go through the journey of being on a FS banking board that fucks up and goes bust, because that's really going to spoil your day, and it's probably going to spoil half the next day as well. And so just from a commercial perspective, yes, there's a prestige element, especially when you're a sort of go faster and trying to move on your career. Yes, there's a prestige element, but also there is a risk return element. And you need to be persuaded in your own mind that A, you can tolerate the risk, and that B, the return is sufficient. If someone said to me, oh, come on my FS board, I'll pay you 10 grand a year, I'll say, yeah, thanks, no. Because the downside is way too much. The effort to do it well is way too great.
Yeah, the downside and the upsides are non-financial, whether they're intellectual stimulation, the pleasure of having colleagues who you trust and respect, the joy of helping a business prosper. It's things like that.
Excellent. So before I wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all you listeners out there on boards, not yet on boards, perhaps to be on boards, and my brand partners for the podcast. Smart is transforming pensions and retirement worldwide. Their leading edge retirement tech platform propelled them success in the UK. Now they're operating on four continents and working with partners like Zurich and JP Morgan. Find out more at www.smart.co. Then listedboard.com, talking of boards, your guide to entrepreneurial governance and how you can start making your board an engine of growth today. So, Neil, you've been portfolioing for many years on boards. I don't think you do consulting anymore, but you do. You are available for pub gigs if anybody wants a Gaelic or Scottish-y folk accordion. So you maybe want to do shout-outs both for your accordioning, you never know who's listening, but also for your day job, and whether you've got any sort of, whether you could be persuaded to sort of take on another sort of crazy board.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Answer to those questions is yes, I'm very happy to play for pubs. I do done funerals and weddings in my time, as well as Cayleys, and quite a few Burns nights and St. Patrick's days. But on the work side, yes. So my two main roles, I've got a couple of small roles at the moment. My two main roles matured last year, so I would be interested in finding other suitable boards. I prefer small companies, and in fact, the mutual model attracts me a lot more than corporate, because I find the removal of that conflict of interest between shareholder and customer actually, I think, frees up a business to be better for society, and also to just to be run in a way that is more satisfying, I think, in that you don't have to solve that dilemma between paying a dividend and suiting doing things to suit your customers.
Excellent. Well, that's another good example of how the model of the structure of how business is conducted worldwide will change over this century, like it has changed over others, and we'll await and see what happens. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank you on my behalf, and also on behalf of the listeners, Neil, for sharing what it's like on the inside of FS organisations. And if nothing else, maybe listeners who were otherwise would have leapt at a chance to be on an FS board actually do a little bit more research before leaping, and a little bit more consideration about all the complex parameters they're working on. FS boards and every board are radically different from what they were when you or I started our careers. I mean, quite frankly, in those days, even the sort of climate board or whatever, you could sit on there and drink tea and eat biscuits and make polite conversation, and that would kind of been okay. And when Sir Paul Tucker was on the show, he said up to the 70s, 1970s, the Bank of England had no responsibility for regulating banks whatsoever. So all of this stuff is very newfangled stuff, and it remains to be seen whether it continues to our grandchildren's days. So thank you very much for that, Neil, and I wish you and your endeavours every success in the future.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for listening. If you're in need of a non-executive or advisory director with deep expertise, experience and contacts in the worlds of both traditional FS and fintech, or unique insight into how to make your board an engine of growth today, contact me at mike@mikeballyman.com. If you just need one-off advice in these areas, via clarity.fm/mikeballyman.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance with me. the firelight.